Welcome to episode 240 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat with Gemba's Rob Mills about fan research, broadcast rights, and sports sponsorship valuation.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host who doctors his photos so you're impressed when you meet him in person, Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, that is my trick when you see him at a conference and you wonder why I'm looking so good. The photos are put on the internet. Aren't that great? You can reach out to me via numerous ways. You can do it via social at Sean Callanan. You can reach out to me on LinkedIn at Sean Callanan, or you can check out the website sportsgeekhq.com, or you can check out the Sports Geek channels at Sports Geek, again on most channels, or you can contact me via email. Who uses email these days? At Sean at sportsgeekhq.com. And also, while I'm getting you to write down handles, because that's what you're doing while you're jogging or walking or sitting in a train, please follow my esports team at Gravitas on Twitter. Thanks to my friends at Twitter for helping us secure that handle. Before I get into my conversation with Rob Mills from Gemba, I just want to talk a little bit about the work that we're doing at Sports Geek around our esports business and around our esports organizing with Gravitas. Still doing a lot of education and training, which has pretty much been the core of what I've been doing in Sports Geek for the last 10 years. If your team needs to be brought up to speed and what's happening in digital, how to tackle new platforms, happy to have that conversation. Obviously, got my pick my brain sessions, the consulting sessions to help you dive in on content and campaign ideas. And even stuff that we discuss here in this conversation with Rob around commercialization and what you're doing in the digital space. Also, you might want to look at esports as a vertical. How do you tackle esports? How do you tackle the Gen Z or Z for my American friends audience? How are they behaving differently? I'm happy to do consulting work and all of that in that space. So please reach out, Sean at sportsgeekhq.com. I love working with podcast listeners. So if you've been thinking about doing that and saying, hey, I want to work with Sean and the Sports Geek team, please reach out. I hope you enjoy this interview with Rob Mills. He from Gemba, a wide-ranging interview talking about a whole bunch of different things that Gemba do, and also talking about their product Turnstile that should really help the sponsorship valuation piece and helping people better understand what sponsorship should be valued at. So this is my chat with Rob Mills from Gemba. Here I am at the offices of Gemba in Melbourne. I'm here with the CEO of Gemba, Rob Mills. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Glad we caught up.
Yes. I think it was nearly 10 or 11 years ago, I think I was in this office and sort of spruiking Sports Geek. And I think I remember the question you gave me. You said, how long have you been doing Sports Geek? And I went, 6 weeks. So, yeah, so it was a while ago when I first stepped in here to talk about what I was doing in the Sports Geek space. But give people a bit of your background. How did you get into sport, and how did Gemba get started?
I stumbled into it. I at uni hated it. A friend said he thought he had a job for me.
What did you do at uni?
I did a Bachelor of Business.
Okay.
With a major in marketing. Hated every month I was there. And a friend said, oh, I've got a job that I think you could do really well. It was a sport and entertainment publishing business.
Okay.
Did that and then did that for a couple of years while I finished my degree and applied for a product management role, not knowing what it was. And it was Adidas. So literally fell in the industry, did 10 years at Adidas and then left Adidas just after the Sydney Olympics and set up what eventually evolved into Gemba.
And so for people who don't know and haven't heard the name before, what does Gemba do?
Yeah, so good question. We provide insights, strategy and comms to the sport and entertainment industry. So that manifests itself in a lot of work with rights holders around sort of everything from commercialization strategies to participation strategies, you know, organizational strategy, et cetera. Brands more focused around sort of how they invest in sport and entertainment, how they measure return on investment, and then right the way through in some cases to actually how they activate that investment. investment as well. So, yeah, sport and entertainment is our sole focus, born out of Asia Pacific, but increasingly doing more work in Europe.
And so it is that very much that, I guess, that research focus to go, who is your fan? What are they doing? Why do they love the sport? Why do they participate? Why do they view? It's pretty much that's really your wheelhouse.
Yeah, and we talk about insight being, I mean, it's a department in our business, but it's a really key philosophy. I think if I go right back to when we started the business, our observation was that it was a really data poor business, and it was a lot of decisions that were made on gut feeling. And where we can, we're trying to help clients make a more informed decision, and there will always be some gut in it, and there should be. You know, otherwise it'll all be very robotic strategies. But it is very much wherever we can, informing by insight, and sometimes insight is quant data, and that's really important. But sometimes it's just that our team are going to sport and entertainment events or esport events and the like, and they see an insight or they see a way that a consumer behaves there that might inform a strategy. So I think sometimes people get put off by that word insight of meaning data, and sometimes it's just a really powerful observation that they might have seen at an
event. So is it a combination? So early on, like almost, you know, there was data around, but it wasn't the amount of data that there is now. So what was that early stuff? You know, if someone came to you as a rights holder and said, you know, we've got crowds and they're falling a little bit, or we're not, you know, people are dropping off, not playing this sport anymore. Like, what did that start? Was it focus groups? Was it, you know, online surveys? Yeah. Was it a bit of both?
It was a bit of both. And I think that's part of, and particularly in the era in now, is I think everyone gets locked on a particular data source as a single source of truth. And I think increasingly what our role is to meld up, you know, our data with client data or third party data to sort of tell that story, because different parts of the data chain will actually help that. I mean, when we started, it was very much, you know, probably pre-social data, where it was traditional consumer research. And that's still a really important part of our mix, because, you know, we can weight that by population and we can look at it by certain category, you know. So social data is great, but I can't necessarily tell from social data who bought Coke in the last 2 weeks.
Yep.
But social data has a really important part in the overall sort of strategy development. So, I mean, our business evolved from a very, you know, traditional consumer research business into using a lot more third-party data. You know, we did some great work in China a couple of years ago where we were overlaying our proprietary data about running in Shanghai with Adidas's data around what was actually being bought in stores with Strava data about where people are running.
Yep.
So you're seeing a story about, well, this is running engagement, this is what's actually selling in store, but this is where people are running in China. So how does that connect, and where should Adidas be putting their stores? And that to me is an interesting example of weaving that data together in a coherent story to help someone make a better decision ultimately.
And I mean, definitely, like from my travels and talking to people in the US market, where the data teams in the professional scene just keep growing and growing every year. And, you know, when everyone says, I want to break into sport, I'm like, how good are you at slicing and dicing in Excel and understanding data and making some interpretations? Like, is that just, have you just seen the continued growth of that space, which is, you know, money ball, but on the business side of things?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were fortunate. We were probably an early mover in that. I mean, we were doing proprietary research before any other agencies, and still even globally, I'm surprised how many times when we go into a new market, you know, we've researched in China now for 10 years. So we've always seen that as a core capability. But yeah, around our business, we have an insights team is obviously great with data. But similarly, our strategy team are also cutting that data in different ways as well. So I think to your point, you know, for someone new coming to the industry, the ability to interpret data, but at the same time, I think also it's how to use data for good, not evil, and not get lost in it. I think that's a really interesting sort of balance. So you almost see these paralysis in organizations sometimes that they won't make a decision until the data tells them the exact solution, and it's not going to usually do that. So that's the sort of the yin and yang of our industry a little bit.
It's a little bit like that's the art and science, isn't it?
It is.
It's like
if
the data tells you this, but then you need someone that can look out at the crowd and see how they're, you know, see how they're behaving and those kind of things to mix with that piece and still have a little bit of gut.
And it's like sport in some ways, isn't it? There'll be a whole lot of performance data that tells a team that this is what they should be doing, what player they should be running. But the instinct of someone on the field to see a gap and just go for it is probably what breaks the game open. So I think it is both, you know, and that's the interesting thing of our roles a little bit.
And you're sort of do you think sport has been dragged into this space by the brands wanting, you know, a bit more certain, like they want the certainty. They want to know what happened. Did this thing work? And their core business, especially if they're, you know, selling a widget and they're doing performance marketing and they're tracking it to its nth degree, then they go to sport and they're not getting that same level. Do you think that's where sport is being dragged into the space?
Yeah, I think so. And it's probably one of the things that informed, you know, the Turnstile, which is a new product we developed last year. We see that the expectation from the buyers in the industry is changing. So the stat that we often quote is, I think by 2021, 51% of marketing budgets will be pushed through digital channels. Yep. Now, some of those digital channels are controlled by sport, so they're not mutually exclusive to our industry. But what it's doing is it's raising the expectation of CMOs and media buying agencies around the type of data they're expecting for the planning and effectiveness measurement. And I think then we look back at sponsorship, which has got quite clunky metrics still. So our view is that as more media is going, more media money is going to digital channels, one, that puts a pressure on sponsorship as a channel because the money's moving, but increasingly it's enhancing the expectation about what they want from us as an industry. So this is not going to go away. And I think, you know, sometimes I get frustrated. People say, oh, well, it's just not possible. It is possible. It's just about how much we're committed to it as an industry.
But it is a bit of, yeah, I'm going to stick my fingers in my ears and just pretend it's not there.
There's a little bit of that still.
Right. It should be presented as an opportunity because as a rights holder, as a team, you know your fans, you've got the most gut information on your fans and you've got your most information data on your fans. And so you've actually got to be able to show that you can deliver that because that was the disruption that Facebook and Google offered. Because I don't need to sponsor Team X to make an offer reach them now. I can just go to Facebook and say, I want to run an offer to those fans because they like that team and bypass the sponsorship opportunity altogether.
Absolutely. And I was meeting with a Premier League team about Turnstile a few months ago, and that's exactly the scenario they painted us. They said, we're not necessarily competing against the other top five Premier League teams. We're competing against Facebook and Google for consumers who can do all that and can give you a two-week media buy as opposed to a five-year long-term commitment where you can't change the rights because they're the rights that you bought 5 years ago. So I think our view is that all those things have to change. And yes, clearly rights holders want certainty and there has to be contracts and those things, but the brands are going to want flexibility. And our view and something that as we think about Turnstile moving forward, I think our view is that there's probably elements of the business that in 5 years' time that will be transacted through programmatic exchanges. Yep. Now, will a Heineken Formula One deal get done automatically? No. But there's plenty of unsold inventory in the market. There's plenty of lower tier clubs and leagues who at the moment are a long way from the buyer.
Yeah.
If you think about sort of, you might have someone in Germany who wants to run a two-week campaign and might want uplift on some signage and hospitality. For that brand actually go and find someone who's got that inventory at the moment, it's almost impossible. So I think as the expectation around data and measurement increases, I think also too probably, and I think the industry should be excited by this, not threatened by it, is we probably start thinking about programmatic and sponsorship in the next 5 to 10 years.
Sooner, because there's so much inventory coming on board, right? Yeah. Because it's not just the top right holders that are now building out these digital platforms. You've got the lower tier leagues coming online because streaming that wasn't accessible 5 years ago is now available. You've got guys like Luke and the guys at Live Graphic Systems that automatically plug in like supers over your graphics and boom, you can start advertising on all of these different games. And so those type of platforms will come there, and you've got a depressed ad market where people are buying banner ads and that money keeps going down. So the association with the IP of a logo, whether it be a Premier League team or a local grassroots team, will have more value than an ad served on a website somewhere. Which Google Ads and Facebook Ads avail to.
And I think a programmatic exchange also sets up that, you know, nirvana that people have been talking about for years, but I think we're getting increasingly close to it where, you know, the Australian Home Centre Court becomes a green screen, and when a Japanese player is playing, it's auctioned like a bit of prime inventory on a digital website, you know. I don't think we're far away from that. But back to your original point, we need the data systems and the platforms to help us transact, because all that technology sort of exists out there, but how you actually set that up in an ecosystem to transact is probably the industry challenge moving forward.
It's just very fragmented.
Yeah, exactly.
And if there's an ability to everyone to plug into a system, it probably smooths everything out, but will present some opportunities from a media buying point of view. You've mentioned China a few times. And like you said, you've been in market in there for many years. There does seem to be a bit of a gold rush for how do we access Chinese fans or how do we reach them? Obviously present their own digital challenges with the Great Firewall of China, obviously. But, you know, what do you think is the opportunity? How much will China be a massive player in the sports market over the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, it will be, and arguably it already is to a large extent. I think, you know, and having lived for a couple of years in Shanghai and seeing a lot of it firsthand, you know, China will do it in its own Chinese way. You know, I think that's the interesting thing too, is that a lot of people, I suppose, you know, the natural paradigm is, oh, they'll look more like a Western sports economy in the future. And elements of it will, but it will also be a very unique economy that China will define how the rest of us deal with it. You know, and that's the way they've done it in automotive and telcos and everything else, and sport won't be any different. But I think, I mean, if you look at that sort of gravitational shift to Asia that's happened, and I've talk a lot about this, but the vision of David Stern at the NBA to do what he did in the 80s and the persistence of doing that, and to see where the NBA is now, you know, people talk about, oh, they got lucky with Yao Ming. There was no luck about what the NBA did. Now, they stuck at that for a long time and they're reaping the rewards from that. And I think, you know, that's when we talk to people about, you know, we'll talk to rights holders in particular about entering China, you know, it's really a conversation of how committed are you? And I think also being really clear what you're trying to get out of China as well. Yeah. I think, you know, it's, you know, there's examples where are you there because you just want to lift your eyeballs because you want to drive sponsor value? Are you there because you have a long-term vision about driving participation? You know, and I always get very nervous when, you know, it's the old sort of, oh, if we could just get 1% of it, you know.
Yeah, that's the napkin math. It's, you know, it's pretty much, you know, it's like this, you're watching a startup on Shark Tank. It's like, there's 300 million people in America. If we get one person of every, like, at that, that is the easy, that's the lazy way of it's looking at China.
Yeah.
When you actually have to respect the way that the platforms that they use and how they go about it. And we've sort of seen some misfirings, I guess, in sport where they've gone, oh, cool, now we've, you know, we're on Weibo. And it's like, what is it? Oh, we're just copying what we're doing on other channels.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, it misses the mark, or you don't have local translators there and that kind of stuff. So, yeah.
And similarly, there's some really, I mean, we took some clients to the League of Legends semi-final in Shanghai, probably 18 months ago. And, you know, we got some local experts to come in and show the streaming services. And there was a couple of clients there who are rights holders and in the media space. And they were sort of thinking about, well, how do they adapt their models? And they looked at this streaming stuff coming out of China. I said, we just need to buy that and white label it. You know, and so there is some gold there in not just number of consumers, but in certain things like streaming and you know, some of the ways that people engage with esport, as you'd know better than I would, they're doing some super cool stuff.
Well, even just, I think it was just a couple of days ago, the guys at Team Liquid are now doing Chinese-specific broadcasts into China as a team. And you've seen the guys at the guys out of Philly, Dignatis, can partner up with SK Telecom and into that region as well, because they realise they can't just, hey, here's our stuff, like it. Like, it's worked well for Team Liquid. They've got Double Lift. He's got a massive Chinese fan base. So they're going to be doing bespoke content into that space and build up that fan base there. So it's something that, you know, they want. There's an appetite for the content. It's just a matter of how do you cater it, because it's not just a matter of, oh, we'll put it on one of the channels and because there's a lot of people, someone's watching that channel and we'll tick that box, because it's only going to have, you know, so much success in that way.
And I think the other thing we've got to remember too is, you know, the Chinese sport economy is a really young proposition, and we're talking to some people recently about football in China, and professional football teams have only been around since the mid to late 90s. So they haven't had that generational handover of whoever your mum and dad barrack for is who you barrack for. You know, so there's a lot of things that are similar about the Chinese market, because in the end we're all human, so we all engage with things probably, you know, in similar ways. But the one that I always jumps out to me that's a big difference with China is when we ask, you know, when we ask Brits or Americans or Australians about name your favourite team or athlete, you can pick whatever you want. Most Brits and Americans and Aussies will pick a team first. You know, we come from a team first culture. The Chinese pick an individual first. You know, so they'll, and literally it's the inverse. So it's 80% in Western markets will pick a team and 20% athletes, and it's 20% for teams in that market. And it's all about individuals. because they don't necessarily have that heritage of team, and they're not necessarily loyal to teams at the moment as well. So, and maybe they never will be either. You know, I think, again, everyone goes, oh, it will swing back to the Western paradigm. You go, maybe in the cult of celebrity that we're in now, maybe it won't.
I mean, you'll use the NBA as an example, and David Stern's done a great job in marketing the players. So it's a little bit of chicken and the egg. Did they cause it? You know, when you see fans, yes, I'm a Miami Heat fan. No, you're a LeBron James fan, and he happens to be in Miami now. Yeah. Like, you know, I'm sure that they now have more Lakers fans, in the same way, you know, Juve's numbers went from, you know, up as soon as Ronaldo turned up. Yeah. So there's that following the star. And the other stuff from, again, without massive generalizations, but talking to people from the esports space and comparing Western esports, which is done very similarly to sport, like here's who played, here's who won, here's what the result was, and yes, we'll profile the players. But a lot in the Eastern method is more entertainment and content, and they're following the players, and that's so it's more like a reality show with the sport intertwined.
Well, it's interesting when we went to the League of Legends semi-final, which was in a beautiful stadium. I mean, in terms of presentation, it was the best sporting event I saw in China. Was an esports semi-final, and the players came out and Faker came up, and the crowd went nuts, whatever. But the shoutcasters are the ones who got the biggest response, to the point where I looked around going, what's going on here? I didn't quite know. And these guys were rock stars, and the whole place was jumping when these guys walked in the stadium, which is so counterintuitive to the traditional sports experiences, you know, like barracking for the commentators. You go, how does that work out?
Yeah. They're the entertainers that would win the Emmy or the Gold Logie or whatever because they're part of the entertainment package. But, it is funny how – I guess just the way that content is framed in both of those markets. And I think it is just because sport comes at it from a sport, the Western world comes at it from a sport angle. And that's where a lot of the people entering esports have come from, like myself, that are, in the sports space and going, oh, we'll adapt these things. But I think there is a lot to learn on the content side, which, we are seeing those trends with player-driven content channels and things like that in both here and the US. But it seems to be the difference between the two leagues from the East and the West. How have you seen, speaking of broadcasts and shoutcasters, broadcast overall has changed dramatically over the past 10 years. We've gone from watching our sport on the one channel, the one rights holder that always had it forever, to them changing sports completely over the summer, as we've had in tennis and cricket over here, to the fragmentation of streaming and all of these different options now that are thrown at the consumer. How has that, I guess, changed your view of the broadcast piece, but then also just the whole consumption of sport, because it's such a different landscape than it was 15 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it affects different parts of our business. I mean, our teams that are working with rights holders and providing advice around broadcast and digital and the like, I mean, it's obviously a lot more of a multifaceted conversation. I mean, I think our first broadcast jobs were, okay, here's a free-to-air channel. How much advertising inventory can they sell? What yield? What percentage of that do you want back? Calculate, bang, whereas now it's multi-channels. And I think, having a clear view of what, again, I think this is something the NBA has done very well, of what do we want certain channels to do. So certain channels we have to monetize, certain providers' eyeballs, some around fan engagement as well. And I think it's an interesting, not only is a commercial yield conversation, but it's also sort of what role you want that channel to play. So, the complication for a rights holder, and in turn the type of work that we do around our broadcast, is it's a lot more multifaceted. And then you're trying to project, what does it look like if Facebook come on board, or, and no one quite knows those things. So they're fascinating pieces of work as a result, because there's a lot of moving parts to it. The work that we do for brands, it's interesting. I suppose it's difficult in some ways, because if you're a sponsor, you used to buy the broadcast partnership with a one network, whereas now that content could be spread across two or three networks plus digital channels, and you can't probably advertise across all of them. So what are you prepared to let go or lose exclusivity on? I think one of the interesting things, and it was in a fascinating conversation with a major rights holder about this in Europe a couple of weeks ago, of they're putting more content behind subscription or paywalls and subscription models, because they're getting better broadcast yields there from a dollars perspective, but has a huge impact on sponsorship values, because the amount of eyeballs are dropping now in an industry that for the last 20 years has defined almost all of sponsorship value through eyeballs. That starts becoming problematic for the industry. So how we start having a broader conversation of the value of sponsorship rather than just being eyeballs, it becomes even more of an imperative, I think. So look, I think it's fragmented and it will probably continue to fragment. I think
because it's been tough because you've had like the NBA goes and signs their, 9-year deal. And you're like, wow, that's a long deal. But it's like, and then you've got to try to see if the lawyers can keep up with the technology, right? Is the other part. I remember early on, Telstra's rights for the AFL was like the internet. Like they pretty much owned everything. And if they wanted to, they could have said, sorry, you guys can't have this thing called Facebook. Because that's what the contract said. But then, over the last probably 5 or 6 years, everyone's been using Facebook and Twitter as the leverage tool, like to say to the pay TV to the TV providers, like, oh, these new kids, these new providers, Amazon and Facebook and Twitter, they're going to come in when, they've – and Facebook still don't know and they're sort of half dabbled and not dabbled and try to do deals so they're sort of in but not completely in.
Yeah.
But it does make it super complex if you're trying to sell your rights because the biggest check has always come from TV.
Yeah. And then you've got the other build on it that you've got an increasing amount of rights holders who have moved – into the value chain of producing their own content with their own, their own media arms. And that's a little bit of a play, I suppose, to provide some competitive tension to some extent as well. But, that's a whole new set of capabilities that needs to sit in these sports organisations that wasn't sitting in many sports organisations 10, 20 years ago. It's probably the most complicated type of work we do for rights holders is broadcast strategy. And as I say, I don't think anyone quite knows where it's going in. So you've got to almost hedge your bets a bit on a few things. And to your point, how you write your contracts becomes really important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, if I'm a TV, like the way that viewing habits are now, nothing makes them turn it on live. Like it's now, reality singing shows and award shows and sport that gets people to turn on the tele because, they've trained everyone to be on demand, to binge watch. Like that's how everyone now does it. So it's like, how do we actually get people to tune in and, what does it look like 10 years, because I know every gamer and that I'm talking to in the esports space, they don't even know how to turn on a TV.
Yeah, right.
Right? And so they just don't because they're always using – everything is streaming.
Yeah.
Everything is on demand. And so, how do those models work in different markets, especially, in the Australian market where there's, 26, 27 million people. How many people are going to tune in or pay for a subscription, those kind of things. Where in other markets like the US, it's quite easy for Major League Baseball to say, this is how we make our money, and then we've got all their regional deals. It's different for every different region.
And I think it's the channel that we get to consumers, and I think it's also the how we deliver sport to consumers too, because I think we've conditioned a generation. And I know I'm the same. My concentration span with watching content's dropped dramatically because I can just have little bite sized chunks of everything, and even more so for that younger generation. I think it was a great quote that's attributed to Adam Silver. He said he'd been watching Twitch, and he said, I think he said something like, "I've seen the future of sports broadcast, and it's Twitch." And he's probably right. You've got the feed there, but you've got
there's social feeds chat.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to me, if you were starting again with sport, it probably looks like that. And yes, there will be a traditional audience who doesn't want all that stuff on the screen, but there's a huge part of the audience, as you said, esport audiences would be a great example who go, "Well, that's what we're used to. That's the norm." Yeah. So you sort of have this sort of other complication of not only multiple channels, but maybe multiple content feeds within different channels as well.
Yeah, but there's also offers it like, so one of the things that I've found understanding the Twitch viewer is how different they are from us, right? Old white guys, right? That, when we see someone say, "Hey, pay for a paywall," we're like, "Oh, don't know, $7, $8, $2 a day. I don't know about that." Whereas they're paying $5 or $6 for a streamer that they like every single month. And they're just, they've never had the introduction of paywalls and say, whoa, not making my day. They're buying that kind of content anyway and subscribing to it and happy to. So they'll have Netflix and YouTube Plus, YouTube Premium, and they'll have Twitch subscribers to multiple things. And so that's how they expect to buy it. So there's these new consumers that are expected to buy it or happy to buy it that way. That will open up new opportunities and go, "Oh, yeah, I want to watch the NBA on Twitch and I do want to be able to chat and I do want to be able to use emotes, I'm happy to pay $5.
Yeah. And you can sort of see the success, you know, in the Australian market of the old Foxtel bottle with a very high, you know, average revenue per user to where we are now with Kayo. You know, that's the continuum we're on, isn't it? It's bite-sized chunks of content, which probably comes back to how easy is that transaction process, isn't it? If I can just click a button and buy.
Yep. Which is what iTunes did with music.
Exactly. Like, if I can buy the last 5 minutes of an NBA game by clicking a button, I'm probably going to pay $5 or £5 for that without blinking, you know. So, yeah, I think it's all exciting, actually. I think it's potentially opens up sport to a whole new audience if we can make it easy.
And, you know, I don't have the data, so I just do it anecdotally. But, like, and I think Adam Silver is sort of quoted and saying, like, once they start watching the bite-sized stuff, like the entrees, they go to the main meal. They do want the subscriber service. Like, you know, and the AFL have done the same size. We didn't think so many people would watch on their phone. Well, the phones are pretty good and you can watch it. But eventually you want to watch it on your big screen, which makes you sign up for a subscription or sign up for or turn on Channel 7 or whatever it is. So the NBA strategy of letting everyone have it and eat as much as they can and then realizing it gives uplift to all the viewing numbers is what more teams or more leagues should follow, I reckon.
Yeah, and I think you know, and really impressed with what Formula One's doing, you know, and obviously, you know, it's at the start of the journey, but by opening up social channels, but also the Netflix content, the amount of people that have said to me, never watched Formula One, but after watching that Netflix content, I'm an all-in because they told the story in a different way and hopefully that brings them into broadcast over time. But, you know, the smarts in that of saying, hey, Netflix is great for long-form content and storytelling and I'm going to build an emotional connection with these drivers and teams who can be sort of quite faceless at the time, I think, you know, is super smart.
And that's where Netflix should be working in sports, like, so we don't keep hearing the Netflix for sports, which we keep hearing is, oh, this is going to be it. It's going to be the Netflix, which effectively is a little bit in this market is KO, effectively in this streaming product. But you know, you're right. Netflix does storytelling well, and so that's where it can integrate sport and that type of content.
The Southampton series, yeah. The story, if you've seen it on Netflix, about the Williams Formula One racing team and the backstory of Claire Williams, Frank Williams, and the matriarch. I mean, of the family, they are great, compelling stories that build an emotional connection with teams and athletes. That I think sometimes we just assume people connect and we've got to go and do some hard work sometimes to make those connections as an industry.
Yeah, it is a little bit of, oh, they go to our game, so they'll watch. And so they'll watch our broadcast. But it's like, you've got to still make heroes of the players, tell the stories behind the scenes, make that personal connection in some way. You mentioned Turnstile a few times. Take us through, like, how that evolved and how that came about and what it is from a product offer.
I suppose Turnstile started about 3 years ago as an internal project, and initially we brought Craig Roberts in, who's our head of strategy now, and we sort of tasked him with a brief that said, look, we're seeing the need for initially better price benchmarking for sponsorship, that if a sponsorship's going to be taken seriously, there needs to be less sort of a black art around pricing. And I'm not talking about media equivalencies here. We're talking about actual sort of price benchmarking. And we'd done a lot of that through a traditional consultancy perspective for 10 years. So we had a really good base of sort of data points and learnings from that. And that sort of started the product development process that ended up in Turnstile. And the thinking was how do we provide buyers and sellers with more robustness around price benchmarking? But to my earlier point, how do we start moving the conversation away from just this pure eyeballs and quantity of logos into more quality of exposure, but also recognizing that outside the pure tangible assets of exposure and ticketing and hospitality, sponsorship has brand value, you know, has IP rights, you know, and people sort of initially said, oh, you can't measure IP and all these sort of things. And we said, well, you can, because, you know, the cleanest example of that is Olympic deals, you know. I mean, Coke has just re-signed an Olympics deal this week and probably less than 5% of that deal will be in ticketing and hospitality and they'll get no exposure in the stadium.
Yep.
So the rest of that big, big deal is intellectual property rights. That's the rights to associate with the rings. Yep. So how do, as an industry, do we start providing benchmarks around, you know, the IP value for Formula One or World Rugby or the Asian Football Confederation? And so that was sort of the brief. And we built that out, thought we had a really sort of strong working prototype and went to Formula One and said, look, we think this is really made for you. You've got a really great mix of a lot of exposure assets, which, you know, Formula One's renowned for, but you've also got this really premium product in IP. We met with, initially with Murray Barnett and Matt Roberts, the head of Insights, and it was one of those great meetings where they got it within 15 minutes. They said, this looks great. Yeah, we're all in. So they became a foundation client and helped us launch, and then we sort of took it to the market, and that was a catalyst for me to move to London last March, was to launch that. So the long-term vision for Turnstile is, how do we build a platform that helps buyers and sellers transact better? So the first thing is, how do you get better robustness around pricing, which is one we've launched. The next module we'll launch is a planning module, which that's remit is, how do you help brands identify the optimal sponsorship? So that will be done through a process of our proprietary data and then weaving in third-party data sources like social media platforms, Twitch, Strava data and the like. And then the flip side of that is, how do you help rights holders then better articulate their audience? For instance, we can size up the fan base of your esport team, so all of a sudden you can go to market and say, I've got all this great Twitch activity, but I've got a community of people of 85,000 people I can talk to you about. So we think by doing those things, we start to bring buyers and sellers closer together because they're talking about the same metrics, and hopefully rather than having very disparate views of pricing, is that we can say, look, there's a range of pricing here and we think it's worth that. So it sort of becomes this sort of data platform that helps sponsorship transact in a more sort of efficient 21st century.
And so to what level it goes down? Because like the pricing, the what do we value is a constant conversation I'm having in the digital space. It's like, hey, Sean, this is what we're doing in the digital space. We've got these channels we're using. So we're putting out this content, we're putting it on these channels, and our sponsorship team doesn't know what to put that value in. And so, for many years I was like, stop selling it for nothing, right? Because then it's valued nothing. And then if we double it next year, it's still going to be nothing, right? So we had to start putting some values in. There was a little of that, art of sticking the finger in the air, and we're going to say, this is going to be worth this because of this. Does it go down to that level to be able to say, what we end up normally doing is, here's a premium Facebook video that's going to have, Buddy Franklin running down the wing. We know it's going to have a lot of engagement. That's a premium one, and we're going to price that at this. To sort of give some ideas, like I've spoken to different people, like Joe Godfrey, when he was at Maple Leaf Sports, had done a lot of stuff where he was coming from a media buying background and sort of doing equivalencies to say, well, this is what we're doing, and trying to, I guess, justify that this is what it's worth, and saying, in his case, the Maple Leaf logo is worth something. Like, because you can just go buy those video views over here, but do you want to do it with here? And the same, with us with Gravitas, it's like, cool, you want to talk to gamers, go for your life. But if you want to talk to gamers alongside Pabu, who took down Faker, like, this is what it's going to be worth. And so that's been a bit of, that's always a bit of to-ing and fro-ing. Do you go down to that level?
Yeah, we do. I mean, we sort of split it into three main components of value, which is benefits, which is ticketing, hospitality, digital rights. So things that have clear market pricing. And you can usually get a pretty agreeable number on that pretty quickly. I mean, I think to your point, digital assets in the sports industry, in our experience, do get a bit of a premium because the engagement levels are higher, et cetera. So we go through and do a rate card review, and obviously as the more – so, we've put about $1.7 billion worth of deals through Turnstile in the last 12 months. So we get a lot of great benchmarks in the industry, so we can sort of review that rate card and give feedback on that. The second thing we look at then is exposure. As I say, and we have – some really cool artificial intelligence software that sort of detects logos, and that's not necessarily unique in the industry, but our point of difference is that we're using global signage rates there. So rather than getting a number that's eight times the sponsorship value, we're actually more calibrated to a piece of inventory that we trade in our industry. Okay. And then we upweight and downweight that based on the ability of that particular inventory to drive brand consideration. So that, and that's a really good example, back to our previous conversation of how you weave different data points together. So we've got some really cool tech that measures, exposure seconds. We've then got a market insight into signage rates, global signage rates. And then we've got some consumer research that says, well, if that bit of inventory actually has a higher ability to drive brand consideration than maybe just a very static press backdrop, then the rights holder should be rewarded for that as well. Yeah. So it's sort of hopefully our ultimate vision is that it allows rights holders maybe to clean the environments up a little bit by a bit more quality rather than quantity. And then the IP piece is saying, okay, well, in its own right, putting aside all those things, a lot of which you can buy on the open market through other channels, what's the power of these communities that we're buying? And there is a market rate for that. You know, there is a clear market rate out there, and our job is to help sort of size up those fan bases and then articulate what that that property can deliver to a partner. So,
it's partly a loaded question. So how do you look at that in the esports space that's still relatively, it's still relatively new and still relatively young, and it's not like it doesn't have the mass appeal that sport does in, you know, obviously different sports have different demographics, but normally it's a wide mainstream. You know, if you're saying here's the NBA, you know, you've got 14-year-old fans and 45-year-old fans. Whereas, you know, if you're talking about esports, you're looking at, you know, 14-year-old fans to 24-year-old fans and mostly male, you know, and that's the demographic. And so I can say, oh, if you want to reach those guys, and you've got a market for that, you know, and I would say if you're a marketer trying to reach a 22-year-old male, it's really hard, right? And so this is what it offers. But I won't offer you every 22-year-old. How do you start taking that data and looking at these newer audiences?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think the overall caveat is that this is not a silver bullet still. You know, there's still, to our earlier conversation, there's some art and science in it. But what we're finding is that, you know, so we can size up your fan base and say, okay, there's X amount of people. And as you said, maybe that's not as big as, another sport or another team. But what we are finding is that there's certain drivers of value. So it's the analogy I give, particularly with the IP benchmarking piece, is it's not dissimilar to real estate, is that you can get a square meter rate for an apartment in London and, you know, there's an agreed rate for it. But if you and I go to the auction and we both love it, or there's a strategic reason why you and I need it because maybe it's opposite a school we want to take our kids, that price changes, you know. And similarly with 14 to 25-year-olds, hard demoed to your point to reach, people will pay a premium for that. So as we're providing feedback on pricing it, we'd be saying, look, here's the average, you know, the average value for your IP, but you've got some characteristics there that say that you maybe get a top quartile deal here that you may, you know, justify a premium. And that premium could be the demo you're delivering. It could be that you're pitching at a category there's a lot of competitive tension, you know. So, in the case of, the finance category globally is pretty competitive, so therefore they get higher yields, where you can directly monetize things so that, you know, the sports kit manufacturers, the betting agencies tend to pay a premium because they have a direct monetization model. So there's factors that we're unlocking and the data's telling us this, we're not making it up, that say, okay, well, those characteristics might say that you should be looking to get a top quartile deal. And vice versa, sometimes we give feedback going, look, you've got nothing in your favor here. Take a bottom quartile deal because the market's not in your favor at the moment. Yeah. So it's trying to provide, I sort of talk about uncoding the market a little bit. You know, the data's all out there. Yeah. It's just we've never been able to sort of understand it, and we've never been able to, and as an industry, we're appalling at sharing information and benchmarking. So what we're doing as an aggregator of all those contracts, because all our work is based off actual contracts, is that we can get a visibility of the market and hopefully provide that back in a confidential way to the industry.
Yeah. And that point of like where you're positioned because it is different depending on like who you're talking to, but then also like you're going from one meeting to another and yes, this is, you know, this sponsor is hot to trot and so it should be in that top quartile, but then you take that same mindset to someone else when you really should just take the deal that's there because they don't need it as much. And it's where a bit of dynamic pricing sort of comes in and knowing who that client is.
And we're unashamedly building this off media disciplines in some way. So, you know, let's think about horse racing as an example. Betting companies pay a premium for a 30-second spot in horse racing versus maybe an alcohol brand because they need that top of mind recall at the point of betting and they pay more. So we know that. So again, the sponsorship industry will have those characteristics. It's just that we've got to work out what they are and provide more range rather than where we are in industry at the moment is we have a media equivalency, which we then arbitrarily say, okay, we're going to discount that by a factor of six to get a price.
Yeah.
It just doesn't, that's not where we need to be as an industry.
And back to the media conversation, like, and this is the part where I'm sort of talking to esports and sort of going through the landscape of who to talk to. And because it's such a digital product and it doesn't yet have, you know, crowds in stadiums every week, that it's partly a conversation with the sponsorship person that wants to activate and like they're interested in activating in an experiential way. So at Melbourne Esports Open and meeting and feeling gaming fans, but then it's really a media buy. And so how is it split up between the activation piece, the sponsorship piece, and well, we just want to make sure the advertisers can get on our broadcast or get on our content. And back to, you know, does that become a programmatic play? And that's the bit that I've been, you know, going backwards and forwards with. So I talk to brands, sponsorship agencies, activation agencies or media buyers, but the answer is all because it's sort of this new product that we're still defining the pieces of.
Yeah, exactly. And that should be a strength of our industry. We shouldn't be lamenting that. I think it's a fantastic strength that we've got, that we can do all those things. I think what's interesting to me though is, you know, how do we, you know, so to take your team's example, how does a media agency get visibility of what you can deliver to a client? Because quite, you know, that most of the bucket of money is still sitting with a media agency. And as an industry, we're a long way from quite frankly, where most of the decisions are being made. So again, which sort of gets back to a little bit of the vision with Turnstile, is how do we articulate your story through data into a media agency environment where they can go, well, we can do some outdoor, we can do some digital. Actually, we've got this really interesting idea here with Gravitas, and here's the market size, and here's the audience we can deliver. We've got to get into that conversation somehow as an industry.
And yeah, it's the same as, you know, I look at, you know, what Hutchie's doing at Croc Media, and he's got all of these platforms, you know, from a radio and TV and digital, and that's how he's going and talking to these media buyers saying, oh, we'll put you here, here and here. And part of me thinks that that's where esports will evolve to in a certain way. And we're seeing it with, you know, Team Liquid and Liquid Media and what they're doing and a few of the other bigger orgs that are doing it that way, whereas a lot of the, you know, some of the orgs are just doing, I guess, the traditional, you know, sport, sponsor logos on jersey, sponsor logos on content, and probably doing, you know, the, oh, we'll sell you X many posts on these channels, which is still a little bit, you know, 5 or 6 years ago of how people were doing it, to, well, what does a bigger campaign look like? What does media buy look like? How do we get those outcomes for you? Type of scenario, which is
So the X factor our industry is then how do we unlock the premium of our IP on top of that? And that's what a, you know, and it's interesting if you look at I look at the broadcast industry, and you mentioned before the, you know, reality TV being apart from sport the only things that rate. I would say that they don't unlock their brands. So it's a buy a 30-second spot. You might pay a bit of a premium. But if that was being sold by the NBA, they would have a completely different model of how to monetize American Idol.
Yeah.
They would go, no, you're sponsoring American Idol, and you'll buy some spots as well.
Yeah.
Rather than you buy the spots and we'll put some integration in. So I think in some ways there's some stuff that we do in sport and entertainment that arguably the broadcasters who would need to unlock more revenue potentially to start thinking about the future as well.
So if people were to reach out to you on the internet, what's the best place and what's the best way to do so?
Look, I'm a Twitter person. I spend a lot of time on Twitter. I engage with a large part of my time is on Twitter. So probably Twitter and but LinkedIn.
Milsey Rob is your Twitter handle.
Exactly.
And otherwise you can go to gembagroup.com.
Yep, thegembagroup.com or turnstilegroup.com for the Turnstile product.
Which we'll put all the links in the show notes. So we're going to get to the closing five. You would do you remember the first sports event you ever attended?
I watched, this is showing my Melbourne heritage, North Melbourne versus South Melbourne at Lakeside Oval. A friend's father took me and I stood next to a police horse that shuttle over my leg for the whole game.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Who's?
Can I say shit on this podcast?
Yeah, you just did. Okay. So, yeah. Apologies to our young listeners who are people listening in the car with their kids. Blame Rob. Do you remember who was playing?
So North Melbourne and South Melbourne.
Yeah. Who that was before they went to Sydney.
Yeah, pre-Sydney. I don't remember the players, but that would have been
David Dench, Malcolm Blight type of era.
Galloping gasometer. Oh, okay. Probably. Yeah, that era, okay. I'd imagine. Yeah.
You would have been to a few sports events in your time at Gemba. Do you have a favourite food memory that you remember of, especially as sport has got more gourmet as the years have gone on? Do you have a favourite food memory or a go-to food when you go to a sports event?
It wasn't particularly glamorous. I had a particularly good hot dog at Madison Square Garden once, and I think I did sit there going, "This is the peak of Americana here." Yep. Yeah, that's probably what it was. Not particularly glamorous, but it did the job.
No, that's all right. You can't go past a hot dog at an American sports event. What's the first app you open in the morning?
Twitter. Yep.
Still Twitter.
Yep.
Checking your mentions. Are you checking the trend, the latest trends, or are you trusting the algorithm to pop up the stuff that you should look
I'm
at?
Wrestling about, do I go the algorithm or do I go the sequential feed? I do vary a little bit on that. Yeah, probably more just a quick trend of what pops up in the explore function there is usually where I go first.
Yeah, I just lean into the algorithm. I just trust that they're going to
trust the algorithm.
That's
a mantra for life. Yeah, trust the algorithm.
Pretty much. Is there someone that you suggest the podcast listeners should follow and why?
Just outside sport, I've been quite fascinated by the whole Trump-Mueller investigation. So Mueller, She Wrote, is a really interesting podcast. There's some comedians who are doing a blow description of the Mueller investigation, which I'm besotted with.
Okay.
So outside sport.
Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, always, really always happy to share. The first thing you've got to do in podcasts is tell people about other podcasts. So, because podcast has a discovery problem. It's really hard to find new podcasts. Yeah, like you sort of need someone to say, hey, check this podcast out. So Mueller, She Wrote. I'll put a link in the show notes. Lastly, and you can answer this maybe as yourself and then maybe put your client recommendation hat on. What social media platform is your MVP? You probably spoiled it to say it's Twitter for yourself.
Oh, look, it's interesting. I mean, I'm a big Twitter fan. I've probably actually found myself, but also Gemba company-wise, gravitating back to LinkedIn a bit more recently, actually. Yep. Yeah, it's just interesting. It gets some quite deep engagement and off LinkedIn.
It has sort of like, I think it's probably been a common answer for the last couple of years. I think the stuff that since Microsoft took it over and to a certain degree Facebook tized it to sort of put a bit more algorithm in it and put a bit more emphasis on good content bubbling up. It does seem to, you open it up and there is some good articles and there is some good videos and it does help you, especially in a global business and you want to connect with people globally. It's the easiest way to do so.
Yeah, yeah. So probably back to LinkedIn a little bit. I think client-wise, I mean, just looking at some stuff that at our conference last week that the guy's been doing, I think most of our clients are probably, strong on Insta at the moment. I think just the ability and to tell stories and, just that as a medium to bring brands to life seems to be a really interesting place for brands at the moment.
It is very much following the algorithm. Like they are following the latest wave.
Yeah.
Like, they were all on the Facebook bandwagon and then Facebook, turned the taps, when they had a bit of trouble and they pretty much said, we're going more community, which throttled the reach on a lot of brands, and brands don't have the excitement of Buddy Franklin running down the wing or LeBron James doing a slam dunk, which, I know the social people bemoan, oh, my reach isn't the same, but I always say, well, you can always go manage a Facebook page for a bank, right, and then find out what engagement's like. Everyone is finding the same on Insta. Like, hopefully everyone knows full well that eventually Zuck will turn that handle and make it a pay-to-play sort of space. But while the velvet rope is open, it's the place, it's what you do. It's pretty much how it's worked with all the platforms.
Yeah, I think the one that I'm trying to spend a bit of time looking at and understand a bit more about is TikTok as well, about sort of where that's going. And, it's interesting that Liverpool's just pressed the button and gone, to TikTok recently. So that's probably the other one that personally I'm trying to get my head around a little bit, how that works and how that fits into the mix of all the other platforms as well.
I think, because there was a time, and again, it makes it sound like I'm talking about the olden days, but there was a time when we would have like a new platform every year. Like Facebook was there, then Twitter was there, then Instagram was there. And then everyone sort of said, we're full. And then we've had Snapchat come and go and is still primarily used by young teens and stuff. They're just not using it how everyone wanted them to use it. Like they're not using it like a broadcast platform. They're using it for all messaging. Obviously Instagram stole a whole bunch of that thing. So we haven't had another platform come and go, take hold. And even if they do, they're going to be these small, niche, non-mainstream platforms, which is what, TikTok is, what Musical.ly was, to go, oh, this really works with this piece. But it does make it really hard for sport who are thin on resources to go, what's our TikTok strategy and how are we getting involved? Yeah. Like, I was at speaking at Youth Marketing Australia and it was a hot topic, TikTok, what's your TikTok strategy? And it's like, well, it's one thing to have a strategy. It doesn't mean you have to be on it, right? It's like, you can, because we are seeing a lot of the best content be produced on other platforms and then end up on Instagram. Like all of the baby filters that we saw whatever it was, 6 weeks ago, they were a Snapchat filter that everyone was sharing on Instagram. So it's funny that, you know, Snapchat and to some degree TikTok and, you know, Vine previously have become like a content creation tool, not so much a platform. So, you know, so it could just be, you know, your strategy could be tell people to do it and get them to send them to you. And it's a, you know, it's a UGC thing rather than like, because the creativity to be a top rate TikTok account for a sports team is, that's a really high bar to set. And then what is the upside for, you know, any team? It's, you know, it's tough because you go, okay, we'll get someone dedicated on TikTok. Is it worth paying someone $50K to run a channel when, yeah, you know, it's the same, you know, the same we went through the same with like Tumblr. Like, hey, we've got to be on Tumblr. It's like, well, 16-year-old girls love it, but is it worth us putting resources into that platform? So that's the balancing act that sports always have to, because they don't have thousands, you know, big teams. They can only do so many things.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, okay.
Because, yeah.
Well, thanks, that helps.
No, I look at it and I go, oh, you know, and, you know, early on it was like another platform, quick, secure your handles. Like that was a strategy. Like just secure your handles. If it takes off, it takes off. Because there was advantages on getting on early and figuring it out when no one's there. So you can do that. But then you also need to decide, you know, I still like, you know, Richard Clark's, when he was at Arsenal, they did one platform a year until they got their processes right and then they moved on to another one. When, you know, here I am with Gravitas and we're like, how many platforms are going to be on? And it's like, no, we'll just pick the main three and we'll just work with those. And until we get more capacity, we will do more things. Because there's so many choices now for teams and you can only spread yourself so thin. And that's why you're seeing a lot of teams sort of pulling away from doing Snapchat because it's very similar to Instagram stories, you know, and then, you know, then, hey, what does TikTok look like? And I'm like, well, if you've got someone in your org that does TikTok and does it well, give it a go. Yeah. But other than that, you know, you don't know where it's going to be. Like Vine had people with millions and millions of loops and then it got turned off and it stopped, you know, stopped being used. So thank you very much for coming on the pod, Rob Mills from Gemba. Appreciate your time.
No, pleasure. No, thank you for having me. It was great to catch up.
New workshops on audience, content, distribution, valuation, and pitch following SportsGeek's Digital to Dollars process. Go to digitaltodollars.com.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, and thanks to Rob Mills. You can send him a tweet. Millsy Rob, he's one of my guests that still tweets. Send him a tweet. Ask him a question on anything that we spoke about. You can connect with him on LinkedIn. There'll be links in the show notes, or you can go to thegembagroup.com. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/240 to get those links and connect with Rob. And as always, please go and talk to my guests, tell them you listened, reach out to them, send them a message on LinkedIn, comment on the post when they share it. I really do appreciate it. And the feedback back to my guests is one of the reasons I keep doing the podcast. It's really great to have the community and you as listeners reaching out to him. A few updates from me. We have, as I mentioned in the last week's episode, we've got the Tech in Sport Hype University of Queensland Spin Accelerator Pitch competition. That's happening in July 10. In Brisbane. So if you're in Brisbane, you want to see what the latest in sports tech is happening and some of the up-and-coming startups with my fellow members of the cohort of the Hype Spin Accelerator, please come to Brisbane. You can grab a ticket, sportsgeekhq.com/hypepitch. You will see myself pitching SG Esports, which is an esports media business built on the pillars of sponsorship, membership, and grassroots, which leverages off a lot of the best practice that we have helped implement in the world of sports and bringing that to esports. But you can also check out other cohorts like Bib, Heartbeat, Movosity, Pummel, Quipmo, Siren Media with Jason Davis, a former podcast guest, SportsCube, Stata with Rory, who is also part of Sports Geek Nation, and also the guys at Stata Sports. So hope to see you there, sportsgeekhq.com/hypepitch. There's actually an article in the Ministry of Sport. I'll put the links in the show notes, sportsgeekhq.com patreon.com/240. That's about it for this episode. Just a quick reminder, you got this far. If you're not part of Sports Geek Nation, you really should do so. You can go to sportsgeeknation.com and you'll find out that it's closed. But you're a podcast listener. You know you get special access. Go to sportsgeeknation.com/connected. We leave the gate open for podcast listeners. Go there, sign up, join the community, join into the conversation with sports executives from around the world, sharing their knowledge, especially in the AMA channel and in multiple channels in the sports business community that we've built out in Sports Geek Nation. We'd love to have you on board. Until next episode, my name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Follow our League of Legends esports team at gravitas.gg. For more resources, go to sportsgeekhq.com. Looking for new campaign ideas to drive new and fresh data and leads? Contact Sean to find out how SportsGeek can help you drive fans into your stadium. It's all about the cheeks in the seats.